Well, it's an honour as well as a pleasure to be here in Bristol and be giving the first lecture at this conference, all the more so because I'm neither a linguist nor a Russianist, or is the word Russologue? I never was quite sure about that. I'm simply a cultural and social historian who happens to think that the history of language is too important to leave to the linguists alone. It expresses and shapes social solidarities and social conflicts, so one cannot write social history without it, let alone cultural history. And I welcome the conference, and still more, of course, this big project of which it is only one part, as another step in the slow rise of a social history of language, rising more rapidly, I have to say, among linguists than among historians, despite the good example of Robert Evans, Willem Freyhof, the late Michael Richter and others, and rising more rapidly, I think, in small countries such as Belgium or Finland or Wales than in larger ones. Although I don't read Russian, or maybe precisely because I don't read Russian, then I was impressed by one day in a bookshop opening War and Peace in the original language, and the French words, of course, jump off the page from the sea of Cyrillic characters surrounding them. It's impossible after that not to be aware of this question of the use of French in Russia. And the conference program suggests that this phenomenon of Russians speaking French to one another is going to receive an extremely thorough analysis in the contributions that follow. So what I'd like to do as an introduction, is overture if you like, is to try to place this phenomenon in a comparative context, to suggest that Russia wasn't unique in this respect, although it may be an extreme case of the speaking of a foreign language by the upper classes. But it's part of a much more general phenomenon of diglossia in early modern Europe. Well, that of course raises the difficult concept. As you know, the term diglossia is contested among linguists. That has its advantages, especially for an outsider, because it means that one can choose one's own definition because there's no consensus. And I suspect that some people later in the conference will be using that term in a sense somewhat different from the one I'm going to use in. It was the word diglossia. It became a technical term about 100 years ago. It was coined to discuss two varieties of modern Greek, katharebaza and demotiki, that is, pure language on one side, people's language on the other. One of them then with a high status, the other with a low status. Of course, the situation today in Greece has changed a lot since then, thanks in particular through the rise and fall of the colonel's regime in the later 20th century. I mean, because the colonels thought that demotiki was left-wing, they were against it, and because the colonels were in favour of katharebaza, people started to abandon it afterwards, so it's all changed. Anyway, in a classic, much-cited article originally published over half a century ago, an expert on colloquial Arabic, Charles Ferguson, used the term diglossia to refer to any two varieties of the same language that were used, often by the same speakers, in different social situations, or if you prefer, different speech domains. So, on one side, a high variety, he called it H for short, used for sermons, used for speeches, used for lectures, formal situations, and on the other side, L, a low or colloquial variety used in everyday life. The speakers, Ferguson, regard H as superior to L. Maybe true for the Arab-speaking world, but I would hesitate to say the same thing about English, where members of the working class still mock a middle class or upper class accent as BBC English. That in their tongue is not a compliment. Anyway, a few years later, another distinguished linguist, Joshua Fisherman, extended the idea of diglossia to refer to languages in the ordinary sense, as well as varieties of a single language. Though he's talking about conditions essentially like the ones that Ferguson talked about, so he used one language like French in formal situations and another, let's say, Flemish in informal ones. And another important extension of the term diglossia is to extend it to different kinds of speakers, with the high status speakers on one side, so whatever they speak is H because they speak it, and on the other side, low status speakers. In the plays of Goldoni, the masters and the mistresses speak Italian, but the servants, of course, speak Venetian. And so, diglossia covers a multitude of situations. And using the term in this rather broad sense, it isn't difficult to find many examples in early modern Europe. In fact, one is overwhelmed with examples, and the only way in which I could possibly compress this talk into the space and time allotted is to try to whittle the subject down a little bit more. So I'm going to talk only about the use of different languages and not about the use of different varieties of language. And I'm only going to talk about spoken languages, even though many contributions in this conference deal with writing, and there is, of course, so much to say about writers who, for one reason or another, sometimes or often wrote letters, poems, or books in a language other than their own. Joachim du Bellay and John Milton wrote poems on occasion in Italian. Mozart wrote letters in Italian. Leibniz and Frederick the Great both published books in French, and so on. Many examples could be cited, but I'm going to focus on the spoken. And what follows is divided into two parts. So the first part is going to be fairly descriptive. I'm going to draw a kind of map. I realise now I should have taken this injunction more literally and produced a map to put up, but I didn't think of it in time, and I'm not terribly good at drawing maps. So a metaphorical map of the main distribution and uses of foreign languages as high forms in Europe between, let's say, the year 1450, more or less, the invention of printing with movable type in the West, and about the year 1800. So, choosing 1800 as a symbol for the time of the rise of nationalism, which discouraged, at least to some extent, the use of foreign languages at home. The second part of the lecture, necessarily more speculative, will consider the various possible meanings of the practice of diglossia for the people who engage in this practice, both for the speakers and the listeners. And I'll also attempt to explain its geography, chronology, sociology, the different reasons for different groups of people in different places and times choosing to speak to one another in a language that was not their own mother tongue. So once again, I'm ruling out interpreters, ruling out the use of a lingua franca, and so on, to focus on this. Speaking a foreign language when you could perfectly well communicate with that other person in your and their mother tongue. Given all these limitations, and now I can actually get down to the mapping, the principal languages that will need to be discussed in approximate chronological order, because there's so much overlap, Latin, German, Italian, Spanish, French. Latin presents a good example of a high form because it wasn't anybody's first language at the time, or virtually no one's. Michel de Montaigne famously claimed that he learned Latin before he learned French or even Gascon, but that isn't a recurrent phenomenon. Latin also happens to fit Ferguson's criteria quite well because it was commonly employed in formal situations, including three that he specifically mentioned: sermons, speeches, lectures, right the way through the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and on occasion into the 19th. A famous Dutch professor of Arabic disgraced himself at the University of Leiden by being unable to give his inaugural lecture in Latin, and this is as late as the 1860s. Whether Latin was much used in conversation between scholars or priests who shared a vernacular, that's a much more difficult question. I rather suspect that Erasmus spoke Latin, almost only Latin, for much of his adult life. He's only recorded as ever having spoken two words of Dutch, and that was on his deathbed. Lieber Gott, dear God, last words he uttered. But Luther, on the other hand, about whose speech practices we've got much more evidence, he habitually spoke both Latin and German. In his so-called table talk, carefully noted down by the students whom he had as paying guests in his house in Wittenberg, you can see him mixing, or maybe better, switching between the two languages. And there's been a rather good monograph about this, which reveals the logic of his choice, whether the logic was conscious or unconscious. So German for everyday down-to-earth topics, but then when he wants to talk theology or philosophy, he slips or shoots into Latin. Why? Well, I'll come back to that later. Second example then, Italian. More exactly, Tuscan, spreading to other regions of Italy as a high form, especially from the 15th century onwards. Well, of course, I shouldn't just say Tuscan. I don't really have time to talk about what Italians call the questione della lingua. That is, look, there was a debate in the 15th and 16th centuries between different Italian scholars and writers about the most appropriate high form for writing, but also for elite speech. Tuscan won, but there were influential supporters, actually Castiglione was one of them, of a more syncretic solution where something would be taken from the dialect of Italian spoken at different courts and they would be amalgamated into a competitor to Tuscan. Anyway, tracing the trajectory of Tuscan outside Italy, among the South Slavs, especially in Ragusa and in Ljubljana, you would have heard a lot of Italian spoken, and not only by Italian immigrants in the 15th and 16th centuries. In Hungary, Italian was used at court in the 15th century, especially in the time of Matthias Corvinus, Matyosh, and his successor, Vladislaus II, or Laszlo. Incidentally, or rather, this is a crucial part of the story, these two kings were successively married to an Italian Beatrice, or Beatrice, I should say, of Naples. In Poland, a little bit later, Italian was spoken at court for similar reasons. In the time of Zygmunt Stary, that is Sigismund the Old, who married another Italian princess, in his case, Bona Sforza of the famous dynasty of Milan. But the best known example, surely, of the use of Italian at a foreign court in early modern Europe must be France in the age of Catherine de' Medici. I should say, therefore, Caterina de' Medici. This is very well documented thanks to the wave of Italophobia that affected France after her husband was killed and she became regent and the religious wars began, and she became increasingly unpopular, also the Italians in her suite. Accused, among other things, of corrupting the pure French language. Spanish, or maybe better to say at this point, Castilian, was another language extensively employed for high purposes in early modern Europe. As not, of course, only in Europe, think of the New World, but I'm concentrating on Europe. Within the Iberian Peninsula, Castilian was a high form in Catalonia, in the Basque Country, in Galicia, in Portugal, competing in that sense with the local vernaculars. But Castilian was also used as a high form in early modern Italy, especially after 1559, when the Milan and Naples and Sicily came under Spanish rule, which meant often governors and viceroys being sent, and of course with them a team of assistants all speaking their own vernacular. In similar fashion and for similar reasons, in the Spanish Netherlands, not yet called Belgium, from the 1560s on, you'd have heard a lot of Spanish spoken in the ranks of the army, but also in the ranks of the civilian administration. At the imperial court in Prague, in the age of Rudolf II, that is late 16th, early 17th century, the emperor was happy to converse in Spanish, which happened to be the language of his mother, Maria. Then, after a very considerable hiatus, Spanish was spoken again at the imperial court, by now located in Vienna, in the early 18th century, the age of Charles VI, or Karl, if you prefer. Moving on to German, that too was employed as a high form in parts of Europe where it wasn't the first language of a majority of the inhabitants. In Denmark, this is particularly well documented, and there have been recent monographs about this. German was the language of the court from the Middle Ages to the late 18th century. It flourished in particular in the time of two 18th century kings, Frederick IV and Christian VI, each of whom had a German mother and a German wife. In Denmark, German was not only spoken at court, it was also spoken in the army, in the church, which was Lutheran. One might suspect something similar, maybe in a milder form, elsewhere in Scandinavia, but I can't find a monograph to read about the regions which we now call Sweden or Norway or Finland. Well, there is one interesting point to make about Norway, which was ruled by the Danes, which is that the Norwegian nobility in the 16th, 17th centuries often spoke Danish as a high form, while the Danes were speaking German as a high form, and the Germans, and coming onto this soon, were speaking French as a high form. The crucial thing is to speak something different from the rest of the people in your country, to put them in their place. I'll come back to that Bourdieu-like argument again later on. Still haven't finished the German, because in Bohemia, German was already in use in some noble circles in the 15th century, but its spread increased after 1526, when the Habsburg Ferdinand I began to rule the lands of the Bohemian crown, and it increased still further, despite a certain backlash, after 1620 under Ferdinand II, when a process of Germanization, at least of the upper classes, accompanied the movement of re-Catholicization after the defeat of the Protestants at the Battle of the White Mountain, Bela Hora. And as I don't have to tell you, Russia enters into the story in the reign of Peter the Great and Tsarina Anna, German spoken at court, but also in the administration, in the army, as in Denmark, and sometimes even in lectures given by expatriate professors, most of whom had German as their mother tongue. But, and you've been waiting for this, I suppose, the most famous instance of the use of a foreign language as a high form in early modern Europe is surely French. At least in the second half of this period, let's say then from around 1650 to around 1800. The Russian aristocracy were very far from being alone in their use of French as a high form, and were indeed anticipated in other places. French was used as a high form, notably in the German-speaking world. For instance, at the court in which Catherine the Great grew up, that small court in Zerbst, to speak French was the norm. The same was true of the court of Brunswick, or should I say Braunschweig, in the late 17th century, thanks in particular to the presence of one French woman, Eleonore d'Olbreuse, first the mistress of the Duke and later his lawful wife. As for Prussia, in the age of Frederick the Great, Voltaire was pleasantly surprised to discover this diglossia himself when he paid his famous visit to Berlin. He wrote home that he felt he was still in France, for everyone, as he put it, spoke French, leaving German simply to soldiers and horses. French was also spoken at the court of Vienna for nearly half a century in the reigns of Franz Stephan I, Maria Theresia, Joseph II, and then again in Spain. So at one time foreign courts speak Spanish. After 1700, when the Bourbon dynasty are put on the Spanish throne, the Spanish court begins to speak French. In the United Provinces of the Netherlands, French was spoken alongside Dutch already in the early 17th century at the court of Frederick Hendrik, Prince Stadthalder, not the king. And by the 18th century, it had become the language of high society in The Hague. By the year 1805, at least according to a French newspaper, French was spoken by the majority of the Dutch upper class, even, says the newspaper, in the interior of their families. Of course, a lot of this evidence is anecdotal, I'll come back to that, but it's what we've got, unfortunately. In Poland, French was the court language in the early 17th century, the age of Władysław IV, whose queen was French, Marie-Louise de Gonzague. And she's said to have spoken nothing but her mother tongue to her husband. And then again, in the late 17th century, this is coincidence in an elective monarchy like Poland, but Jan Sobieski, too, was married to a French woman, Marie Casimir. Always spoke to her in French, and of course wrote his famous love letters to his Marie Sienka in French as well. In other words, in the case of French, one might say that the Russian court was following the example of its Polish neighbour, as indeed it did in other cultural respects in the 17th century. But thinking about the implications of all this, maps are useful, or actually indispensable simplifications. But we know that they are generally a lot less reliable than they may look at first sight. Reconstructing the history of spoken languages from textual evidence is a hazardous enterprise. I've quoted some of the most famous testimonies like Voltaire. But I don't think we can take these testimonies too literally. I think, I don't know whether in the study of the subject of this conference in the past, scholars have tended to assume that all the Russian aristocracy spoke French, or that they spoke French all the time, or that their French was always correct. But if such assumptions were made, then I would indeed be very suspicious of all three. Arguing by analogy with much better documented and much more recent situations, it's surely only prudent to assume the opposite. That is, the upper class did not speak a foreign language all the time, even in high domains. They didn't always speak correctly either, and they sometimes mixed their languages, whether consciously or unconsciously. I'm glad to discover that in the case of Dutch, Willem Freyhof agrees with me, and in one of his essays on the use of French in the Dutch Republic, he compares what he calls the Franderlands spoken in the 17th and 18th centuries, a kind of mixture of French and Dutch, with what he calls the Dunglish spoken in the Netherlands today, much like Singlish, Spanglish, Swinglish, and all the other Englishes that have escaped from the control of native speakers to develop into luxuriant and independent varieties of the language. In other words, mixing the mother tongue with French phrases, and conversely mixing one's French with phrases from the mother tongue, all this appears to have been common practice. Every now and then one has some clues from the 17th and 18th century suggesting that this was indeed the case. From this point of view, the Dutch equivalent of War and Peace might be a novel published in 1782, Sarah Wuchervaart, written by two women, Betje Wolf and Achja Deken. It's an epistolary novel. The letters keep close to colloquial forms of Dutch, but they're also full of French phrases. Petit maître, charmant, ma chère, je suis enragé, and so on. I'm just quoting the first three or four letters because this practice goes on throughout the whole book. Returning for one moment to Charles Ferguson on Arabic diglossia, it's worth pointing out maybe he has been severely criticized by later linguists for his assumption of the separation between High Arabic and Low Arabic. Other linguists who specialize on the Arab world say that we can't assume the existence of firm frontiers like this, as whatever you call it, interference, contamination, anyway, words, phrases, moving between the high and low domains. We shouldn't assume the existence of firm frontiers maybe anywhere in culture, but should be prepared to expect mixing and switching almost anywhere. To a cultural historian like myself, hybridity seems a crucial part of the human condition. Well, so much for the map. And now comes the more speculative, controversial part, in which this, because this socio-cultural phenomenon cries out for an explanation, or more exactly, for a variety of explanations that will cover a variety of situations. In the first place, I make a few remarks about internal explanation, which is more the domain, I think, of linguists and historians, but in the interest of a total picture, be absurd to leave it out. The early modern period was, as one used to say, every schoolboy knows, the time of the so-called rise of the vernaculars in early modern Europe, more exactly, the rise of some vernaculars, all at the expense of Latin, but some of them at the expense of other vernaculars, and a rise in the sense of there being, of certain vernaculars being increasingly employed for writing and for speaking in high situations. Especially, indeed, for writing philosophy, for writing epic poetry, making speeches, giving lectures. Now, it took a long time for most European universities to accept this, but you do find a little in the 17th and more in the 18th century that professors are employing the vernacular. Now, for a long time, all the same, it remained extremely difficult to have a conversation about philosophy in particular, including natural philosophy, what we call natural science now, without switching into Latin, because of the relative poverty of the vernaculars, where abstractions and technical terms of philosophers were concerned. This is exactly why, shortly, Martin Luther, in full flow at the dinner table, suddenly wanting to make a point about the doctrine of grace or whatever, switches from one sentence to another from German into Latin. And it seems strange today to think of German as a language which was poor in abstractions, but the 16th century is very different from the 19th century in this respect. And so that would encourage writing and speaking in a foreign language, which helped to keep the vernacular poor in this particular respect. It's to some degree self-perpetuating, but not so strongly self-perpetuating, not to change gradually in the course of the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries. I have to admit that all these considerations are more relevant to writing than speaking, more relevant to scholars than to nobles, but I don't think they should be left out altogether. The use of a foreign language also implies, I think, a view of one's own language as inferior or even barbarous, at least in certain respects. And such a view does seem to have been quite widespread among the upper classes in many parts of early modern Europe. But what's interesting to a historian is to see that this pessimistic view of one's own language is increasingly challenged in one country after another. In his famous Défense et illustration de la langue française, the poet Joachim du Bellay still felt he needed to discussed the idea that France, that French was a barbarous language, but he does this only to reject it. He doesn't accept that French is inferior to Italian. And gradually, one sees, usually published, but sometimes only in manuscript, the rise of a whole series of examples of a new genre, the praise of one's own vernacular. The Italians do it, the French do it, the Spaniards do it, the Dutch do it, the English do it, a bit later the Germans do it, the Poles, the Hungarians, the Swedes, finally even the Icelanders are doing it before the end of the early modern period. So much then for internal explanations of the use of foreign languages to communicate between people who have the same mother tongue. But now to turn to the external explanations. In a word, politics dominates. I'm not going to offer an exclusively political interpretation, but politics has got to play a rather large part in what follows. Indeed, some linguists today like to write about what they call the geopolitics of language, and others quite often about dominated languages and dominant languages. And especially in colonial situations, but not exclusively in those situations. Languages of conquest are the most obvious example: Spanish in Mexico and Peru, French in Brittany and Occitania, English in Wales and Ireland, all in the early modern period. And the terms dominant and dominated are particularly appropriate when the use of the language of the conquerors is enforced, at least in some situations. In parenthesis, because this is not about Europe, in the European colonies of the early modern period, it's intriguing to see different governments, Dutch, Spanish, and others, oscillating between two opposite policies. And sometimes they try to compel the indigenous inhabitants to speak a European language, and sometimes they try to forbid them from speaking, as if it's very difficult for them to make up their minds. But that's outside Europe. More often, though, as you know, the use of a foreign language as a high form reveals cultural hegemony rather than naked power relations. And this lasted a long time. In the south of France, as late as the 19th century, when Gascon or Provençal was still the language of everyday life for almost everybody, French might be not used as a mark of a special occasion or a mark of respect. For example, a boy asking a girl to dance for the first time might like to mark the occasion by switching into French. And again in the south of France in the 19th century, French might be expected in church for sermons, especially sermons preached on special occasions, even if, as is extremely likely, the majority of the congregation could not understand what was being said. In the case of Spanish, in the age of Philip II to Philip IV, so 1550 to 1650 more or less, linguistic hegemony was in part the result of the association between the language and the increasing political power, both in Europe and elsewhere, of the state where Castilian was spoken as a mother tongue. On the other hand, I don't think we can explain the hegemony of German without bringing in trade. That is, before it was ever a language of the court, Low German was penetrating Scandinavia and other places as a trade language. In the case of Italian, its hegemony was almost purely cultural, depending more than anything on the publication of the poems of Petrarch. In Italy, what people spoke about, the great trio of Dante, Petrarch and Boccaccio, but in the early modern period, Dante was not taken as seriously as he had been, or he would be. Boccaccio didn't circulate so much in other countries, but on the other hand, reading Petrarch in the original was almost indispensable for a courtly lover in quite a number of European countries in the 16th century. And both ladies and gentlemen liked to have themselves portrayed with a small book in their hands and would ask the painter to make sure that the onlooker could read the first line of a famous sonnet by Petrarch. Even here, politics comes into it a little bit, because Grand Duke Cosimo de' Medici of Tuscany in the middle of the 16th century very astutely promoted the use of Tuscan outside Tuscany, I think as a way of legitimating his regime, which, because it was relatively new, and in fact he came to power by a coup d'etat, he felt was in particular need of such legitimation. It's a similar story, better known in the case of French. Its appeal was both political and cultural. It was the language of the court of Louis XIV, which became a model court even for France's enemies in the late 17th and still into the 18th century. Think of the number of copies of Versailles produced by architects in the service of princes who were frequently at war with Louis, and I suppose Schoenbrunn as the most obvious example. So French was becoming the language of politeness, politesse, language of civilization, language of enlightenment. One might indeed compare the successful spread of French from the middle of the 17th century onwards with the success of French fashions. You know, in some European countries, until about the year 1650, the most prestigious foreign fashion was Spanish. But Spanish fashions were quite rapidly displaced by French fashions in the second half of the 17th century, just at the time that French was competing successfully with Spanish, and of course just at the time that Louis XIV was successfully insisting that France took precedence of Spain, you know, on international occasions. Even if his diplomats had to ride down the coaches of rival diplomats in the streets of London, it was actually happened as a way of asserting this precedence. Now, the sociological analysis of the late Pierre Bourdieu reminds us that diglossia may also be used as a weapon in conflicts, social conflicts, inside a given society. Bourdieu's famous study La Distinction, published as long ago as 1979, discussed the many ways in which one social class, the bourgeoisie, distinguished itself from another that it believed to be lower, in food, in clothes, in the furnishing of rooms, in taste for music, and so many other respects. Language is, of course, part of the story, even though Bourdieu hardly says anything about it in that book. He made up for that a bit later. And even if the role of language in putting people in their social place may be less important in France today than it remains in Britain, or at least in England. So I'd like to suggest that, in a way, the use of foreign languages by the upper and middle classes in the early modern period is rather like the use of slang by teenagers, beggars, or thieves, because in all these cases, the language used is a powerful symbol or marker of an in-group. It's a powerful means of excluding outsiders. So it's so much for some attempts to answer why questions. Of course, we also have to answer how questions. What are the mechanisms by which these foreign languages can arrive at this important position in the culture of different countries? And I think the importance of one single institution in the history of diglossia deserves to be emphasized, and that is, of course, the court. Especially when, as so often happens, a king marries a foreign queen and she arrives with many of her compatriots in her suite, in her baggage, in a way, and they get established in important positions in the court. Because the example of the court was often followed by nobles elsewhere, and the example of nobles was often followed by an aspiring middle class, and so on. This argument, of course, is famously associated with the sociologist Norbert Elias, originally from Breslau, now Wrocław, and later teaching at the University of Leicester. But surprisingly, in his famous book on the civilizing process and the role of the court in establishing good table manners and so on, he says very little about language. Yet it seems to me that the history of language illustrates the arguments of Elias extremely well. Speaking about the mechanisms, another conclusion that somewhat to my surprise emerged while I was reading and in preparation for writing this paper. A conclusion emerged that might be summed up in one well-known phrase: "Cherchez la femme." The role of queens in the process of diglossia does deserve to be noted. Rulers in their own right, like Caterina de' Medici and Catherine the Great, wives and mothers, in the case of the spread of Italian, Beatrice of Naples and Bona Sforza. In the case of Spanish, Maria of Spain, mother of Rudolf II. In the case of German, Louise of Mecklenburg, wife of Frederick IV of Denmark, mother of his successor, Christian VI. For French, Marie-Louise de Gonzague, Marie Casimir, and Eleanor d'Olbreuse. So, in a much more literal sense than one might have expected, a number of European rulers spoke their mother tongue, their mother's tongue, even if it happened to be different from that of the majority of their subjects. In short, early modern European diglossia offers a series of examples of the power of women, cultural power, soft power, it's true, whether it was exercised directly or behind the scenes. Finally, I just want to raise a fascinating but difficult question: what were the consequences of this widespread cultural phenomenon. Without, I don't think one can write a proper history of anything without the why, how, and with what consequences, difficult as they may be to establish. In a brilliant essay that you will be much more familiar with than I am, Yuri Lotman argued that for Russian nobles from the age of Peter the Great on, everyday behaviour became a sphere in which teaching was needed, making the nobleman a foreigner in his own country. Learning how, having to learn how to behave rather than following tradition turned the nobleman into a foreigner. It turned everyday life into theatre. You had to follow the script. Once again, curiously enough, Lotman doesn't talk about diglossia in the essay, and yet the practice of Russians speaking French to other Russians surely makes one of the most vivid illustrations of what he is talking about. And the question he raises that I think we have to raise and which I can't answer, was there a psychological price to be paid? Were these 18th century Russians divided selves? Did they feel some kind of linguistic or cultural self-hatred? Or did the Germans, who spent so much of their time in speaking French in the late 17th and the 18th centuries, or all the other people I've mentioned who invested so heavily in a foreign language? Supposing that this were to have been the case, then one might view the decline of the use of foreign languages as high falls in Europe in the age of nationalism, a slow decline. I know, of course, there's plenty of evidence from the 19th century of the persistence, maybe on the smaller scale of this phenomenon. But anyway, one might view it as an inevitable reaction to an intolerable situation. But in any case, national identity came to trump class identity in the 19th century, just as localism came to trump universalism. The famous Russian controversy between Westernizers and Slavophiles might reasonably be viewed not so much as a unique event confined to Russian history, but rather as an extreme case of a very common Western phenomenon, maybe not just Western, but part of the long conflict between xenophilia and xenophobia. Thank you.